The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I was inspired today to talk a bit about a fundamental part of meditation practice and mindfulness practice, and that is mindfulness of breathing. And I think it's always good to go back to basics. It's one of the skills that really useful in life to develop, the skill of being with the breath, using the breath, focusing on the breath, and becoming familiar with the whole experience of what it's like to bring attention to breathing. And it's a lifetime learning to learn to be with the breath. I've been focusing on meditation on the breath for over 40 years now, and I feel like I'm still learning about it, and partly because it's such an intimately connected part of living. And as I live my life, breathing changes, and my relationship to breath changes, and the way the breath reflects back on me the rest of my life, it comes alive more and more. Some people find it difficult to work with breathing, to meditate with breathing as a focus. And if you think you're one of those people, then you probably have a lot of company. Because I still think I have a difficulty with breathing after 40 years sometimes. Because sometimes my mind doesn't want to focus there. Sometimes it's all kinds of things going on. But I find it invaluable to come back to my breathing, to focus on breathing. And here's one reason why I find it so useful. Is that I think of attention as kind of like food that you can use to feed something. So if your attention, your precious attention, goes into your preoccupations, you're feeding the forces of preoccupation. If you put your attention into the breathing, for example, instead of your preoccupations, then you're reinforcing and strengthening your ability to stay with your breathing. If you put your attention into being in the present moment in a kind of open way, then you're supporting and strengthening, nourishing that capacity to be present here. I think it's fair to say that for many people in ordinary life, their attention is not feeding their capacity to be present. It's not feeding their capacity to be focused and here and now. But rather, it's feeding their neurosis, or feeding their anxiety, or feeding their planning mind, or feeding their whatever, you know, we tend to focus on a lot. And the more we focus on something, the more we strengthen it. And so we have to be a little bit careful about what we give ourselves over to. And I think it's fair to say that for some people, they lose themselves in certain preoccupations and concerns. And in losing themselves in it, they're actually reinforcing sometimes negative habits, negative ways of thinking, negative kind of unused things, ways of being which are not so useful. And so part of the task of waking up, of being present, is to somehow switch the focus from being preoccupied, for being really occupied here in the present moment, really here in a full way. And I think that the process of doing that is a great story, is a great little adventure every time you have to do it. And it doesn't make it a good novel, you know, but it's still a story that you sit down and everything's nice, and then you think it's nice maybe, and then there's a challenge. And then you have to somehow contend with a challenge. And then hopefully you overcome that challenge. And then you enter into kind of a new life. That's a nice story. And so you sit down to meditate and you discover that you're really concerned with, I guess, your taxes, right? They're due in 2 days. And sorry if I reminded you. And so you find yourself preoccupied about something. But it makes it really hard to be present, which is what you want to do. So then you figure, how am I going to be present? How am I going to kind of, you know, overcome this distraction? And there's a variety of tools, a variety of ways that people do that in meditation. But one of the simplest ways is to come back to breathing and let the food of attention go into your breathing rather than going into the preoccupation. And one of the advantages of this is that we're not getting engaged, we're not contending with the preoccupation directly. Sometimes that's very useful to do, but sometimes when we kind of go into the world of preoccupation to try to fix it or solve it or think our way out of it, it just pulls us in further and deeper into it. But to kind of give ourselves over to breathing, and the mind goes back to the preoccupation, we come back to the breathing, mind goes back to the preoccupation, goes back to the breathing, because that's what makes a good story. You know, because if it was just easy, you know, then it wouldn't be a story. And so you come back, and then slowly what's happening is you're beginning to give less and less food, energy, to the preoccupation, and more of it tends to go into the breathing. And then at some point there's a tipping point that comes where it becomes easier to stay with the breathing than it is to be pulled into the preoccupation. And at that point, there's sometimes a kind of like an in-between point like that, a tipping point, where what becomes important, more than any other time perhaps, or what becomes available, is to make a decision, is to have a choice, an intention. Okay, now what I really want to do is to stay with my breathing. Breathing feels really alive, it's present, it's clear, there's a settled feeling in it. And this is actually a richer life to be present for than to be in the two-dimensional world of thinking and thoughts and plannings and all these concerns we have. That there's something about the breathing, I think of it as three-dimensional rather than two-dimensional, because it's embodied. It kind of fills our body, fills the present moment in an embodied kind of way, which if we're too preoccupied in thoughts, we lose touch with the body. And so that whole dimension of the physicality begins to kind of recede from us. And so at some point we can feel, oh, you know, I think I'm going to really choose, decide, here's where I want to be with the breathing. And then it allows us to kind of get more and more focused, deeper and deeper into breathing, and it becomes more and more of a joy, more and more of a blessing. I think for the uninitiated, it's unimaginable that the breathing could bring a tremendous amount of joy, tremendous amount of blessing, tremendous amount of aliveness, a kind of rebirth experience. That something as simple as breathing can be enough in order to feel completely alive and present in a meaningful way. To be present, sit here with confidence, with sense of purpose, sense of aliveness. Just to be alive is enough, just here. It can seem unimaginable when the mind has a habit of being preoccupied with concerns and purposes and figuring things out and attaining things and new projects and, you know, all the wants and the fears and anxieties we have. And it can seem like our concerns, our preoccupations, are the most important thing. And that's part of the reason why we get preoccupied, because our preoccupations have a certain authority with them, that they seem important. And they are maybe important, but are they important enough to spend our time meditating, thinking about them? Are they important enough for us to always be thinking about? Or can we have more choice about when we pick them up and when we put them down? So the idea that you could let go of your preoccupations because there's something more important to do is one of the things that supports the ability to use the breathing to wake up, use the breathing to have a feeling of real sense of joy, delight, cleansiness, purification, healing, openness, something really, you know, different people have a different experience with this. So sometimes I'll meditate in the middle of the day, and usually I meditate in the morning. And most often I meditate in the middle of the day if I find myself with thinking that I have too many tasks I have to do. And so I've been doing tasks, different things I have to do. And after a while, because I'm doing it frequently, regularly, that a habit energy in the mind picks up that of the task mind. Got to do this, got to do that, got to do this. And there's a kind of swirling or energy or tightness or kind of perpetual motion machine in the brain, seemingly, that kind of is just kind of caught up in these concerns. And if I start noticing that mind goes into the swirl of thinking about this, I have too many things to do, how am I going to do them, and I have to do this and that, and then I find the best things I can do is sit down to meditate. And when I first started doing this many years ago, there would be a voice inside that would say, you can't do that, because I have to get these things done. And meditating is very inefficient for getting the important things in life done, unless meditation is the important thing. And so I'll sit sometimes just for 10 minutes, and then when I finish meditating, I feel refreshed. And then I'll pick up the tasks I have to do, and my impression is I'm much more efficient. And certainly I enjoy it better, because I'm not kind of claustrophobic with I'm taking care of one thing and I'm already thinking about the next three things or getting crowded with all these concerns. I'm just there for that one thing. There's like lots of space for the experience, just like this here. And it becomes a pleasure to do something which 10 minutes earlier was a drag. Oh, one more thing, one more email, you got to give me a break. You know, all these emails I get. And I look at all those unopened emails. And oh no, one more email. And I meditate for 10 minutes, and like, I don't care how many, you know, just like I'm here with the next email, just that email. There's lots of space, and I take care of that, and then I take care of the next one, and the next one. And then I have to meditate again. But the idea is not so much, the authority of the to-do list, the authority of the anxieties, the authority of the problems we have in our life, the authority of the trains of thought we have, that, oh, no one likes me, life is hard, the future is dark and forbidding, and nothing's ever going to be good again. It's all kinds of worlds of thoughts and ideas that we get preoccupied with. And I would suggest it has some kind of authority, otherwise we wouldn't get pulled into it. And part of what we're trying to do with breathing and meditation is to switch that authority away from our preoccupations to understanding the tremendous value of just being present here in the simplicity of this moment. And it's quite remarkable that some of the greatest sense of well-being that a person can have can come by entering into the world of breathing, and that's all you do. It can be phenomenally healing for some kinds of pains and wounds that people have. It can be phenomenally relieving, given how much we're caught up in worries and cares and resentments and all kinds of things, to be able to put all that down. So how do we put it down? So the first thing, one of the things I said earlier, is when you use breathing, when you sit down to use breathing meditation, at first, it's better not to try to do a good job. Because when people try to be a good meditator, they usually mess up. They usually have too high a standard, and then they measure themselves against, you know, the fact that they're not doing a very well job, and so then they're critical and they give up. But rather to sit down with a kind of sense of contentment, maybe, or a sense of willingness, a sense of just willingness to be with who you are and how you are at that moment. And not to fight yourself and not to criticize yourself, but even so, come back to your breathing. Even if it's just for half a breath, even if just for one breath, and the mind goes off. You come back for half a breath, and the mind goes off. And after a while, you start noticing where the mind is going. And you notice it's always going into the same kind of preoccupation. And then you realize, wow, I didn't know how concerned I was, how I caught up in this particular theme. And I know for me, when I sit down to meditate, one of the values of it is that I kind of catch up to myself. I get to discover what are the feelings, what are the thoughts, what are the concerns that are operating that I haven't really noticed as I went around my daily life. I sit down and I got to see, oh, look at that. I'm really concerned about X, Y, and Z. Or I sit down and I'm quiet for a while and then I realize, you know, I forgot something. And so, you know, that comes up and I see that. Or there's certain feelings I have, emotions I have that I didn't really notice because I was doing emails. And then, so then I sit down and I get to feel what's going on. Or I feel what's going on myself physically. And for me, often enough, when I sit down to meditate during the day, I'll notice that I'm holding my tension in my body. It's much more subtle than it used to be, but I'll feel like a little bit tightening in the shoulders. It's a common thing. I think because the being on email and computer, you know, it does, for me, I kind of pull my shoulders in and up a little bit, and if I do that chronically, then they kind of gets, you know, tense there. So I haven't noticed that so well until I sit down to meditate. And then I notice the effect on my shoulders. Sometimes I notice the effect of how I've been living on my breathing itself. Because sometimes I can have a little resistance in the top of my chest and the rib cage as I sit down to meditate because I've been held there. So I'm beginning to discover and recognizing what's going on for me. And I don't have any sense that this is wrong or bad, that, you know, poor Gil. It's just, oh, this is how I've been living my life, and now I get to meet it. I get to see what's going on. And so for me, focusing on breathing is a way of understanding myself better, seeing myself more and more deeply. The mind wanders off, and then I come back. Mind wanders off, and I come back. And one of the kind of my first Vipassana teachers and first teachers in Vipassana here in America was Sharon Salzberg. And she wrote a poem called The Breathing Poem. And nowadays she lives in New York, so I kind of think of this as maybe written in New York. Sirens whine, still I breathe. My first breath, my last breath, and still I breathe. Noises in the ductwork, still I breathe. A poem composes itself in my head. Still I breathe. Mind wanders. Still I breathe. Shoulders tense. Still I breathe. Knee screams. And still I breathe. Arm itches. And still I breathe. Eye twitches. And still I breathe. Thinking. Still I breathe. Doors slam, and still I breathe. Birds chirp, still I breathe. Wind sings, still I breathe. Is that legal to repeat the same line so often in a poem? So the idea that still I breathe, coming back, still I breathe. I'm breathing. It can be phenomenally effective to keep us from getting caught, preoccupied, to kind of be fresh again, kind of a new beginning, a renaissance. Every time we breathe, if you kind of really can be in the breath fully, oh, this too, now, present for this. And slowly over time, the attraction, the pull, the energy to our thoughts and preoccupation begins to weaken. And as it weakens, we're less pulled into it. As we become less interested in our thoughts, we get less pulled into it. And then we start entering into the world of breathing more and more deeply. Somewhere around the time of the Buddha was a man in China named Mencius. And Mencius wrote, I am good at nurturing my flood-like breath. I like this. I'm good at nurturing my flood-like breath. The whole experience of breathing floods over, fills you. Inhale and exhale. Nurturing it. Do you nurture your breath? Are you the caretaker of your breathing? This breath is extremely vast and strong. I nurture it with straightforwardness and do not injure it. And so it fills everything between heaven and earth. I nurture it with straightforwardness. Like, I'm not sure what he meant, but I love the idea of just being straightforward, present in a simple, direct way, nothing complicated. And do not injure it. Do you injure your breathing? I think that in a certain kind of way I do. If I get tense and hold myself for those emails, and I get a little bit contracted, there's a kind of injury going on. It kind of limits it, it kind of holds it, restricts it. And many people can keep their breath restricted for a lifetime. They hold their belly tight, or they're kind of caved in, or there's a certain kind of holding that has become habitual. In a certain way, we're being restricted. Some people, when they sit down to have this unrestricted, open, flood-like breath, the first thing they have to do is to cry. And they might have to cry for days, because what's being held back is all this sorrow that they've been holding for a long time. Sometimes what has to be released is the anger of a lifetime that's been held there. And so that has to flood through, because the breath's been holding it down, so I'm going to kind of restricting it. So there's a certain kind of, as the breathing becomes more and more free, more relaxed, it kind of frees up so much what's in us. And it frees up what's maybe unresolved, so we can finally deal with it. But it also can free up what's most beautiful in us. I think the capacity for love, for generosity, for compassion, works so much better when we're unpreoccupied, when we're not closed or restricted. So come back to your breathing. Come back to your breathing. Let the breathing be a teacher for you, so you can learn more and more about yourself. It's a fantastic teacher. We need to have a reference point to see ourselves well. So as a teaching I often give, I kind of came upon it when I was teaching up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and there was a little creek next to the retreat center. And I went for a walk and looked at the creek one day. And I saw that I could not tell if the water was moving. It was completely clear water. And I was looking down and said, is that water moving or is it still in the creek? So I went and got a little stick, and I put the stick vertically into the water. And then I saw there was a little wake that got formed on the edge of the stick. And then I saw there was a current. So sometimes we don't see the currents of our life that are flowing, what's going on for us, emotionally, physically, mentally, all kinds of ways, until we have some kind of reference point in which we can see it, the movement. Sometimes the movements are invisible. And so this breathing, the constant rhythm of breathing in and breathing out, if you can try to stay with that and focus on it, that reveals the currents of our lives. Some people discover it's not just a current, it's a whirlpool. It's pure chaos in there. They didn't know how busy and active the mind was until we tried to sit still. And so all kinds of things get revealed and we discover. As these things fall away, more and more falls away, the past falls away, the future falls away, self-concern falls away. As we stop thinking so much, many of our problems disappear, or the problems dissolve. Not that they've been solved, but in the moment, they're not really present. Because you can decide for yourself what percentage of your problems only exist in your thinking. If you were able not to think about it, would it be here? Some thoughts, some problems are mostly conceptual that we kind of make for ourselves in our own mind, the imaginary mind. Some problems are real world problems, real concerns to have, and need problem solving in order to solve. But we don't have to be solving them all the time. In fact, sometimes thinking about them all the time, it's amazing how repetitive we can be for a very small return. I mean, in some ways, the success rate in some people's thinking is very, very poor. I mean, when I was younger, I was concerned that, that I wasn't somehow, in high school, I didn't have a lot of friends, and people didn't like me, and I had to somehow be somehow different. I had a whole world that I lived in. And I thought about it and tried to solve it and fix it, and I suffered with it. And my success rate in solving that particular problem, issue in my life, myself, was zero. That's a very poor return on the investment. And I can't tell you how many things in my life I've been caught up in thoughts and ideas for a long time sometimes, and then realized at some point that I wasted my time. And one of the stories is when I was living at the Zen monastery, I spent a whole year expecting to be made the head cook because I was clearly the best cook in the monastery. I had spent a whole year working in the kitchen, and I'd been the kitchen manager, and I'd really kind of done a great job, and I knew everybody else in the monastery, and I was really the one. And so it was a little bit of a privileged job in the monastery, and I enjoyed the cooking and the menu planning and everything. And so I spent a whole year waiting for that next year when that changing of the guard happened, new job assignments were made. Every meal, and the meals were done in the meditation hall in meditation posture like this, so it's like kind of a meditation thing. It wasn't like you're eating and chatting, you're sitting in silence eating. And almost every meal, analyzing the menu that was served, considering what I was going to do, planning for what I was going to be like when I became the cook, because obviously I was going to be the cook. And then the day came in April, where we did a ritual form where they were going to, so we all stood in the meditation hall in a circle, and the job assignments were read out. And they came to me. And I was not made the cook. And as soon as I saw that, then I realized, what have I been doing this last year? especially in the meditation hall, I was sitting there in meditation posture. You're kind of supposed to be meditating and be present as you eat. And I spent this whole year not doing it, thinking about food and menus. again, a zero return on the investment, except now I have a good story to tell. So sometimes it doesn't help us to keep thinking and rethinking and thinking again. Sometimes the best thing we can do for ourselves is to stop the swirl and currents and caught upness of our mind so we can get a fresh mind, a clear mind. And not a few people have discovered that once they can get focused and simple and relaxed and absorbed in their breathing, that they become so much more creative. It's a fresh mind, it's a creative mind, they can see things in new perspectives. And it can seem counterintuitive to go, because you're supposed to go towards your problems to fix them, but to willingly put them aside, put them up on the shelf for a while, so that you can get refreshed, so you can tap into a deeper wellsprings of creativity, of compassion, of our deeper sense of connectedness with our values and what's most important for us. That's sometimes it's counterintuitive. And if, you know, and breathing, I mean, wow, breathing is like so pedestrian. It's so ordinary, simple, you know, it's so far away from all the things that are important in life. So to be willing to enter into the world of breathing for the uninitiated would seem really strange. Why should I? But to start being interested in your breathing, curious, to learn about it, learn about yourself as you breathe, to enter into the world of breathing, to discover how to be with breathing so that it's nourishing for you and you can nourish the breathing. To discover a way into that world is a skill which is really, really useful to develop. Because the breathing is always available. So there it is. And sometimes it might take a while to learn how to be with the breath in an effective way. Some people have a lot of strong habits around breathing, a lot of strong emotions connected to it, that or a lot of attitudes about doing breathing, that they kind of get tighter or more contracted in doing it at first. Some people, the breathing, some people have a strong tendency towards anxiety. Where they focus on the breathing, that makes them more anxious. So there's all kinds of challenges, but it's a really good challenge to address. It's a really good one to work your way through that, sometimes with the help of a teacher, sometimes learning alternative ways of entering into that world, not to doing it directly. But the world of your breathing, that's a world that can fill, as Mencius says, fill heaven and earth, flood-like breath that kind of fills you. And I think that what really fills you is not the breathing exactly, but is mindfulness of breathing, the awareness of breathing, the fullness of breathing. So at the beginning I said, before the sitting, that one of the ways, there's many ways, one of the ways of looking upon breathing is to see that the experience of breathing, the physical experience of breathing, can meet awareness. Awareness can meet the experience of breathing. That's what we're trying to do, is to connect these two. And there's a variety of ways they can meet and be connected. Awareness can enter into the experience of breathing and kind of become one with it. But a very nice way that I like is that of it's kind of like looking at the horizon, where awareness touches the experience. It doesn't sink into it, doesn't submerge in it, but it also is not distant from it. It's just right there. And for me, the image of the horizon, for me, I go immediately to the idea of the ocean, looking out across the sea. And this vast space, vast sky all around, and this great, the ocean, this kind of vast, you know, flat expanse of the ocean. And then there's this line where this sky, in a sense, the space and the ocean meets at the horizon. And for me, looking at that, I can look at that for a long time and feel very relaxed, and very kind of spacious and peaceful. And so to have this, you know, that's where the place where mindfulness, awareness and breathing meet. It's like the horizon. It's a place where we can kind of discover how to be peaceful, spacious, to have a breathing room for everything. Everything can fit in that space of mind into all that. So I'd like to end with poem that my wife wrote that I didn't know she wrote until this weekend. We were talking and she said, oh, I have this for you. And this is the end of it. And I think of it as coming out of her meditation. It's not directly about breathing, but you can imagine someone coming back, wandering off, coming back, wandering off, coming back to the breathing. Settle, settle, like raindrops falling on a pond, merging with the water, over and over again. When the rain stops, the water is clear. So, exactly what she means, I don't know. But that's part of what the poetry is like. But for me, it was this idea, you come back, the mind wanders off in thought, you come back, mind wanders off in thought, come back. And slowly, the rain of thoughts that come and splash, quiet down. Finally, the rain stops, the thought stops. And there's very pure and clear, peaceful. So, if I may, I would encourage you to have your breathing become your best friend. It's one of the best resources you have. And it's worth cultivating that friendship. If you're currently enemies, then heal the relationship. Become friends with your breathing so that your breathing can really support you. Great help. I think it's one of the great supports of my life. And I think so much of my what's good in my life, I feel, has really arisen out of the foundation of meditation and mindfulness on breathing. It's been that important for me. So that's the foundation. Thank you.